Just because someone does the right thing doesn't necessarily mean they always do it with the right attitude. You might have succumbed to this yourself. Paying taxes is the right thing to do. I usually don't have the right attitude in doing it. Going to the dentist, right thing to do. I hate going to the dentist. So my attitude is pretty sour. They'll ask me there, so how's your day? I say, well, I'm here. That should say a lot, because my countenance is not good. Confronting people with sins, that's the right action if it's necessary. I'm not sure we always do it with the right attitude. I know I haven't always done it with the right attitude. Doing good deeds begrudgingly, right action, wrong attitude. So what am I getting at? Well, just because you have a positive attitude, positive disposition, doesn't mean you're always going to do the right thing. Proverbs chapter 2, verse 14, it says that the sinful and the godless delight in doing evil and rejoice in the perversity of evil. And you see that even today, people rejoicing and reveling in doing sordid and wicked things. So just because you're rejoicing doesn't mean that you're rejoicing over the right things. Just because you're rejoicing doesn't mean you're suddenly a godly person. Ungodly people rejoice in their ungodliness. They rejoice in their sin. The ideal approach, of course, would be to do the right thing with the right attitude. And that should be the disposition of every Christian. This ought to be my disposition. This ought to be your disposition. Paul concurs with that in Philippians chapter 4, verse 4 through 7. And he's giving us another secret of success here, another part of that formula for inward happiness, and that is to rejoice in the Lord. Because of who the Lord is, and because of our tremendous gratitude for our fellowship with Him, there's that right action, rejoice in the Lord. But then there's that right attitude out of gratitude and out of appreciation, not begrudgingly, not, you know, obligatory, not, you know, because you have to, but because you get to, like what Andy was talking about. So we want to do this. This is not a superficial mindset, not a shallow Sunday morning sentiment. This is a soul-touching, heart-transforming prescription for life. And it's not something that we should do. Rejoice in the Lord always. It's not something we should do only when everything is going well and when everyone is cooperating with our plans. But it's something that we should do, as he says, always. So this secret that he's giving us will meet our spiritual needs over time. It will feed your soul. It will meet your soul's best interests. And it imitates Jesus' own heart. That's why it's so powerful and why I'm going to devote an entire lesson just to these few verses here in Philippians chapter 4. So he says here in verse 4, rejoice in the Lord always. Again, I will say rejoice. It's worth repeating. And that word rejoice there means to be glad, to be uplifted, and literally to be full of joy. What he's saying here, as you see on the screen, find inward joy for who you are. Find that inward joy for what you believe in. Most of all, find that inward joy for who you believe in, for who you belong to. Christianity provides the purest, noblest, most comprehensive plan for life than any other religion or philosophy on the planet. If you don't believe that, then it won't help you. But if you do believe that and you pursue that, then it will help you immensely. And when he says always, he doesn't mean like at every single moment of the day, but not rarely or randomly either. He's saying, do this habitually. It's kind of like 1 Thessalonians 5:17, where he says, pray without ceasing. Well, if you take that literally, if you're not praying right now, you're disobedient to the word. But that's not what Paul meant. He just means make it a habitual practice to pray. And when we rejoice in the Lord always, we're making it a habitual practice to be rejoicing, to be joyful in the Lord. And I'll be honest with you, and I think this is needs to be said, there's some days that you may not feel like rejoicing. There's some days I don't feel like rejoicing, quite honestly. Life is hard. I don't know if you've noticed that. Discipleship to Christ is even harder. And there are some days that are filled with darkness and sadness and bad news. And there's days that are that we experience pain and loss and heartache and grief. In my opinion, for what it's worth, on such days, we should not feel guilty for not expressing outward joy as if we're being unfaithful to God, as if we're sinning against God. Because those days are there, and that's part of being human. It's part of life. Life is often cruel and unfair, unpredictable, and brings its share of heartaches to us. We bring our own sometimes, yes, but life itself brings heartaches. And for what it's worth, too, I am certain that Jesus did not rejoice when he was driving the money changers out of the temple with his scourge there, to overturning the tables. I am sure that Jesus was not rejoicing when he watched multitudes walking away from him after a very difficult discourse there in John chapter 6. I'm sure that in John 8:24, when he said to the Pharisees, "If you don't believe that I am he, that you will die in my sins," that Jesus had a big smile on his face and was thinking in his mind right at that moment, "I rejoice in the Lord always." And I don't believe that Jesus was rejoicing when he was in the Garden of Gethsemane, there praying so hard, "If it be your will, let this cup pass from me," praying so hard that blood was coming from his forehead. I don't believe that Jesus was rejoicing when he was arrested and then being mocked in front of the Jews and the Romans. And I don't believe for a minute that Jesus was rejoicing when those nails went through his hands and his feet and he was put up on the cross. When you have to bear your cross, are you rejoicing? Probably not for the cross-bearing experience itself. But on the other hand, and this is a big point to make here, Jesus' life always exercised and conveyed a sense of calm assurance. Whatever he did derive tremendous joy for doing the right thing. That's where he found his joy. Hebrews chapter 12, verse 2, he talks about, "For the joy set before him, he endured the cross," and so on, despising the shame. It wasn't the cross itself that he found joy in. Who would find joy in being crucified? But it was what lay beyond the cross that he found his joy. And he internalized that joy. It wasn't just a joyful moment, like a superficial joyful moment. Like when someone tells a joke and you laugh, that's a joyful moment. That's not internalizing that joy. To internalize the joy means that there's something far deeper than the moment itself and what's going on in that moment itself. There's a calm assurance that I'm doing the right thing and that this right thing is pleasing to God. That's what makes it right. And that God is seeing me with great favor. He made the joy of obedience to his Father his own personal joy. The one was a result of the other. Obedience, then joy. Joy because of obedience. He wasn't joyful without being obedient. And so it is with you and with me. Paul is not saying, "Rejoice in the Lord always," in the absence of our obedience and our righteousness and our trusting in God. Rather, he's saying, "Obey God, be righteous, trust in God, and then rejoice in the Lord always." Not because of what you did, necessarily, but because you are doing what God asked you to do. You are doing the right thing. And God rewards such people. And that is a cause for rejoicing. That doesn't mean for a minute that we are oblivious to the pain and the heartache and the troubles of life, but that we are able to rejoice regardless. There's a lot of people suffering in the world. You know that, right? You see it on TV. You see it on the social media. You see it, everywhere. Sometimes you see it yourself with your own eyes. There's people suffering all the time. They have no joy. That's a miserable way to live, without joy, without hope. But we can be rejoicing regardless of what we have to live through. In other words, don't limit rejoicing to perfect days and sunshine and beautiful conditions and absolutely immaculate and optimal circumstances and everyone doing perfect things, and you look around and the world is perfect, flowers blooming, bunny rabbits, sunshine, rainbows, and you're like, rejoice in the Lord always. This is a great day. Because usually those days don't happen. And if they do, they're few and far between. And what we get instead is mundane, tedious, task-driven days. And then we get bad news. And then we get people disappointing us. And then we get us disappointing ourselves. Those are the days we need to look past what's going on and still say, but this is what God's doing for me, and I can rejoice in the Lord despite all that. And the key here, too, is in the Lord. First of all, not only as a result of our own obedience, which is important, but doesn't save us. In other words, you're not going to be saved just because you've been obedient, because you've been disobedient as well, and that nixes the deal right there. But because of Christ's obedience, you are saved. And that's what we want to focus on as we rejoice in the Lord always, where we're not just saying, because of my faithfulness, I can rejoice, but more so, and more importantly, because of Christ's obedience and Christ's faithfulness, I am saved. Because of what he did for me, I am a recipient of his success. I have victory through him. I triumph because of him and because of what he triumphed over. I have overcome the world, Jesus said. Well, Chad has not overcome the world. And even if I did overcome the world today, tomorrow I might fall flat on my face. So it's not about what I do or what you do. It's more about what Jesus has done and what he continues to do. And secondly, we rejoice in the Lord because we are in the Lord. And therefore, we can have fellowship with him in that context. We have a good standing with God. We have heaven in our heart. We are forgiven by the blood of Christ. I hope that's what you were thinking about when you took the Lord's Supper. That is the source of our forgiveness. That body, that blood was given as an offering for you so that you could be forgiven by God. How can you rejoice if you aren't forgiven? Why would you rejoice except in ignorance if you aren't forgiven? So this rejoicing isn't just a mere good mood or positive attitude or optimistic outlook. Even unbelievers can have all those things, good moods, positive attitudes, optimistic outlooks, and yet they're not Christians. And it's not going to save their souls to have a good mood or a good day or even a good life. Have you ever talked to sinners, people who are irreligious or just, you know, that they're not Christians, and you ask them, how's life? Oh, living the dream. You know, everything's great. It's all coming up roses and all those other cliche statements that people make. That's what they tell themselves. They're convinced that that's how it is. But spiritually speaking, they're a mess. They just don't know it. Or they just don't want to admit it. Or they just don't want to do something about it. God isn't saying, as long as you feel like you're saved or worthy or righteous, then that's reason for rejoicing. No one should be rejoicing who remains outside a covenant relationship with God. So this rejoicing in the Lord is really important to understand. We're not just rejoicing. We're rejoicing because of the context that we are in. So we're not just trying to convince ourselves to rejoice without any good reason. The fact is, we have the very best reasons as Christians to rejoice. And so we want to focus on those, regardless of what else is going on. We want to focus on the good reasons that we have. The world doesn't have good reasons for rejoicing. The ungodly don't have good reasons. Atheists don't have good reasons. The irreligious don't have good reasons. False teachers and those who follow them don't have good reasons. But we have good reason to rejoice. Remember when Jesus sent out his disciples there in Luke chapter 10, and they all came back and they were like, oh, even the demons are listening to us and obeying us and miracles and all that kind of stuff. You remember what Jesus said to them? If I could paraphrase, he says, that's really good because that needed to happen. but you should be rejoicing, not because you can cast out demons, but, does anyone remember? Because your names are recorded in heaven. That's what he said. Why should you rejoice? Because you are a great Bible student? Because you can give great lessons, like Andy did? Okay, or because you have memorized verses, or because you can sing better than most people? No, you should rejoice because your name is recorded in heaven, if indeed it really is. And you should know that, whether it is or not. You should know that. That's not something you should guess at. You can have confidence in that if you listen to and obey what Jesus is talking about. In chapter 4, verse 5, Philippians 4, 5, he says, after saying, rejoice in the Lord, he says, let your gentle spirit be known to all men. The Lord is near. A lot of people avoid that verse because the verse before it is so potent. So they focus on the rejoicing in the Lord, but they don't get the rest of that. Not because it's not important in itself. That word gentle is also translated moderation, Christian love, or forbearance. Let your Christian love, let your forbearance be seen before all men. What he's saying here is to exhibit an attitude or a personal demeanor that is consistent with Christian values and Christian expectations. If I could put it more bluntly, walk like Jesus walked and act like Jesus acted. Walk the walk, talk the talk. That's what he's saying here in essence. And that implies certain things. First of all, we are not seeking perfect justice here. In our gentle spirit, we're recognizing that we're not going to get perfect justice in this world. We're not seeking perfect people here because we know people themselves, including ourselves, are not ideal. And therefore, if that's true and we know that factually, then we can absorb losses and we can sustain hardships and we can forbear imperfections of other people and immature efforts of other people, just like God does with you and me every single day. We can do those things. Be gentle with other people. Why? Because God is gentle with you. If God wasn't gentle with you, then you would have been crushed to pieces a long time ago. I'm certain of it, and so would I. But God is not wanting to crush us. He's not wanting to destroy us. He's wanting to save us. But he does ask that we show the same attitude toward others that he himself is showing toward us. Let your gentle spirit be seen before all men teaches that it's better to suffer loss and to suffer wrong than to inflict loss and wrong on other people. And it's better to live, to wait on the Lord rather than to insist on your own way. I don't know if anyone here has ever insisted on their own way before. Okay, I'm the only one. I thought so. It's better to forgive than to foster bitterness and resentment. That's part of your gentle spirit there. And it's better to live with a view to heaven than to live with a view of just dying. A lot of Christians, especially when they get older, all they think about is dying. They don't think about living for the Lord. They feel like they've already done that, and now it's just waiting for death. That is not a gentle spirit. That is not consistent with what Christ would do. And all of this, I just said, is connected to rejoicing because you can't be rejoicing if you're angry and brooding over injustices in the world and the injustices of other people. And you can't allow emotions and memories and disappointments and disillusionments to fill your heart because you're not going to have joy over those things, especially if those memories are bad. So one crowds out the other. If you let all that negative stuff come in, then it's going to crowd out all the positive rejoicing and the positive outlook and that positive for the joy set before us. We endure these things. And then he says that the Lord is near. And I realize that this has two different meanings. In the big picture perspective, it means Jesus could come at any minute. The Lord is near. And you can safely say that. It's not wrong to say. It's not like Paul was misled in any way or misleading us by saying Jesus is near and then 2,000 years have passed and Jesus still isn't here. What he means is, in essence, that Jesus could be here at any moment. That is nearness in itself. So that's one aspect of that nearness, is that he could return, and therefore his return is always near. The second aspect here is that the Lord is near to our heart. And if the Lord is near to your heart, then do you have reason to rejoice? And should you be a rejoicing person? That's really what we're looking at here, is that idea. We want to be preparing for our eternal future when Jesus comes. We want to do that. How do we do that? Well, we know the commandments. We keep those to the best of our ability. We let our gentle spirit be known before others. We are forbearing. We are forgiving as needed. We are not brooding and angry and sullen and all those other things. So we want to see the positive aspect. Actually, I wanted to say something before I left this point. In having the Lord near to your heart, that gives him controlling interest over you. I wanted to say something about controlling interest because I think that's a phrase I have used several times and I haven't always explained what I mean by that. Let me illustrate it this way. Ooh, I'm going to pull an Andy moment. So this is what it's like down here. Suppose you're a teenager. Go back, some of you. Some of you have to go way back. I'm sorry. But suppose you're a teenager and you're going to high school and there's a bully. And you are the target of that bully. And every day you go to school, you're not thinking about your schoolwork. You're not thinking about time with your friends. You're not thinking about your academic progress and so on. You're thinking about the bully. Now, whether that bully does anything to you on a given day or not doesn't matter. You're always thinking about him. That bully has controlling interest over your thoughts. You see what I'm saying? Maybe it's not a bully. Maybe you have never had a bully. I don't know. I never really had a bully. Actually, in kindergarten, I did. But anyway, that's a long story. But I've had bad bosses. Maybe you've had a bad boss. And every day you go to work, and you have to really submit to that boss. And he's a bully, in a sense. And if you have a bad boss, and you dread going to work because of that, and you dread being at work because of that, and you're really living your life in dread rather than in joy, that boss has controlling interest over you. You see what I'm getting at? So when we talk about controlling interest, we're not talking about being possessed by demons and things like that, like people think. We're just talking about letting someone or something control you. So when I say that the Lord should have controlling interest of you because the Lord is near, then that means that you are positively being controlled by him. And who are you thinking about all day long? Not the bully, not the boss. You're thinking about the Lord. And the Lord's never going to bully you. And he's never going to boss you around and intimidate you. The Lord's always going to work in your favor, and the Lord's always going to do good for you, always going to bring about good for you. That's what I mean there by that controlling interest. And that's really what Paul is talking about when he talks about the Lord being near. Chapter 4, verse 6. Be anxious for nothing, but in everything by prayer and supplication, with thanksgiving, let your requests be made known to God. This is easy advice, very difficult to practice. The word anxious there in the Greek means overly concerned or obsessively caring. It's most often translated in your New Testament as worry or worrying. So be anxious for nothing means don't worry about anything. That's really what that means. Paul is saying here, don't allow fear and stress and anxiety to rob you of your hope and your joy. How can you be joyful and rejoicing in the Lord always if you're full of fear and anxiety. And that other word that we don't often associate with fear, but is, and stress. How can you be full of joy when you're filled with those instead? I have to tell you, I have struggled with this all my life. And I'm trying hard right now to overcome that, and I hope that you are too, if you've been struggling with that. And I will tell you, from personal experience, it interferes with our success. It immobilizes us, keeps us from moving forward. It ruins our effectiveness, and it ruins our influence. It robs us of joy, but it also robs us of our confidence. It robs us of our deep friendships. It robs us of our intimacy. It robs us of hope. How many times did Jesus say, "Do not fear"? Because fear and faith are at opposite ends of the spectrum. And so really when Jesus is saying, when he says, "Do not fear," what he's really saying is, have faith. Have faith, have faith. Be anxious for nothing. And in prayer, give your fear and your anxiety to the Lord, not only because it helps us, but because he's telling us to do it. He's giving you a tool to work with. It is a commandment. You can look at it that way. I'd rather look at it, though, as a tool, as a resource, something that he wants us to use. Tools are good. If you've ever worked on a car and had the right tools to work on the car with, it makes your job a whole lot easier. When you don't have the right tools, it's either really difficult or it just ain't going to happen. Having the right tool means a lot. And when we have the right tools from God, then we can work on our lives the way that he wants us to. Prayer is the deepest and most profound form of communication. Nothing can replace it. Nothing can duplicate it. It transcends mere words or verbalization of ideas and emotions and feelings. We're really, literally bearing our soul before God in prayer. It's the right action, but it requires the right attitude as well. Not just let my will be done, but far more importantly, let his will be done. God, let your will be done. I have a whole lesson on that coming up. I just have to have the strength to do it because it will be difficult to give. Your will be done. I've learned a lot about what that means. We're not asking from selfish motives, like James talked about in James 4, verse 1 through 3. We're not asking for God's help apart from our full surrender of our own heart. We're not saying, "God, help me in my stubbornness. Help me in my hard-heartedness. Help me in my resolve to do things my way. Please help me to get my resolve done." That's not what we're doing. So in prayer, we humbly but gladly acknowledge God, as the giver of life and a giver of every blessing. He is our supplier. He is our benefactor. He is our shield. He is our protector. And we must come to him believing in all of that. Prayer is a gift of God. It's really an expression of God's grace. It's designed to humble us, yes, but also to put full confidence in him. Paul is saying, stop letting worry and anxiety and fear control your life and talk to God about that. Give that over to God. And that's exactly what Peter says here. I think I have this up here. Yeah, what Peter says, humble yourselves under the mighty hand of God that he may exalt you at the proper time, casting all your anxiety on him. Why? Because he cares about you. Does God care about you? Does God care when you have fear and anxiety? Does God care when you're suffering? Does God care when you're hurting? Does God care when you have lost somebody in your life? I have no reason to believe that he doesn't care about those things. He does care. That doesn't mean that those things go away because he cares, but he's asking us to do something about that. What about when you're stressing over what to do? Big decisions ahead of you. You're anxious over those things. Fear welling up. Worrying, stress. What are you supposed to do? What am I supposed to do? I'm supposed to give it to God. Those are difficult things to do, but that's exactly what he's asking us to do. And he's not saying create a void without filling it with something else. Be anxious for nothing. In other words, don't be anxious about anything. But let your requests be made known to God. This is what you should be doing instead of that. Instead of being anxious, this is what you should be doing, is what Paul is teaching us. Let your requests be made known to God. If you're going to cease being anxious and worrisome and stressed, must be filled with something else instead, is what he's saying. It means that we're talking and communicating with the one who has all knowledge, all wisdom, all power to guide us through whatever is causing our fear and anxiety. We're opening our heart not only to be exposed by him, but because we want to let him into our heart. The Lord is near. And recognize that. And I know what someone's going to say, because I've said it myself. Well, I know the Lord can help me, but I don't know if he will help me. Maybe you've said those words. I have. That's where I got the material for this lesson, from my own missteps and mistakes about this. It's the wrong idea. God will always help those who put their trust in him. But how he helps him, and when he helps him, and to what extent he helps that person, that's his decision. But it doesn't mean that he's not helping you just because things didn't turn out the way that you wanted them to turn out. Because that's where we get stuck right there. We lay our expectations before God and say, here is my expectations. Now, Lord, what are you going to do to fulfill those things? Not your will, but mine be done, is what we're saying in that case. Prayer must be viewed as a source of refuge and a calm assurance and with deep faith. We're not exchanging our present fear and anxiety for another fear and anxiety, now worrying whether God's going to help us or not. Here's my fear about what's going on. Now God says, here's my fear to you about whether I'm going to do anything for you. That's not what Christianity is all about. And then he talks about supplication, by prayer and supplication. That word there, supplication, literally means asking to be supplied with something. You recognize that there's something missing and lacking and inadequate in your life. You're asking and seeking and knocking on God's door, in essence, for him to reveal what that is and to provide whatever is lacking that is necessary and to heighten or depend upon him. And don't be vague about this and general, ambiguous, like, help me to be a better person. Help me to be more spiritual. Those are vague prayer requests that really don't help you and really give God very little to work with, so to speak. Be specific when you can. You're not telling God how or when or what to fill with. You're just making the request. God, I am lacking in supplies here. I don't know what I need, but please supply it, whatever you see that I need. And that's what Hebrews is talking about here, is that equipping. God, the God of peace, will equip you in every good thing to do his will, working in us that which is pleasing in his sight. So let that sink in. Remember who you're dealing with. You're not just crossing your fingers. You know that crossing your fingers and good luck charms and coincidences, that's all part of pagan mysticism. I hear Christians say things like that, like, well, good luck with your spiritual walk. What? Like, be pagan and Christian all at the same time. It's not about those things. It's about what God is actively doing for us. But that's not where Paul ends that. He also says, with thanksgiving, there in verse 6, let your requests be made known to God. Gratitude for the past, gratitude for the present, and gratitude for future blessings in the form of promises that he gives to us. This shows humility and respect and our dependence upon God. Even when we're going through great ordeals and trials and stress, we still have many things to be thankful for. Because while few things in your life may not be going well, most of them are and probably have been going well for some time. And that's true probably on any given day. So, in other words, being thankful and grateful puts things into their right perspective. Instead of dwelling and obsessing over your present anxiety, you know, the wringing of hands and, you know, that stressing, which is easy to do, and I've done it, so I understand it. Realize that that might be small in that big picture perspective. What were you anxious about 10 years ago? What were you anxious about 20 years ago? You probably don't even remember. But at the time, it was a big deal. And now it's gone. And you've moved on. Big picture perspective. James 1:17 says that every good thing, every perfect gift comes down from the Father of lights, in whom there is no shifting shadow. Without thanksgiving, we are unwilling to recognize those good gifts and those perfect gifts that God gives to us always. Gratitude and reverence go hand in hand, but so do ingratitude and irreverence. If you have gratitude, genuine gratitude, then you will show reverence. And if you have no gratitude, then that is irreverent. And there is nothing in between those two things. If one, then the other. So what's the result of all this? Well, that's in verse 7. And the peace of God, which surpasses all comprehension, or your version might say mind or human mind, will guard your hearts and your minds in Christ Jesus. When you trust in God and His power to bring order to your chaos, to resolve life's greatest difficulties that you're facing, to remove your anxiety and replace that with confidence and hope, that's when you experience that peace that Paul is talking about right here. Someone says, well, what is that peace? And my answer is, I don't know. But I do know that it surpasses human explanation, which is why I don't know it. It surpasses comprehension. We can experience it, but we can't describe it. But we also cannot duplicate it with lesser or inferior solutions. And this is what people do. They try to find peace through vices, through addictions, through moralism, righteous living, through piety, holy lifestyle. Through church going, being good church members brings peace, right? Not necessarily at all. Not this kind of peace anyway. But just because we can't comprehend this peace doesn't mean we can't have it and enjoy it. Because we receive God's love even though we don't understand it. We commune with God even though we don't understand really who He is. I've never seen Him, never heard His voice. Don't know a whole lot about Him other than what He said about Himself. So we don't have to know things fully in order to enjoy the experience, so to speak. And not only does the experience of peace surpass comprehension, but also what it does and how it strengthens the heart and our faith and how it keeps us from being skeptical and cynical. And when we're overwhelmed with sorrow and pain and disappointment and despair, that guarding of our hearts and minds will take us to a different place. Instead of doubting God's mercy and grace, we're trusting in it. And so we can go through a lot of stuff, a lot of bad stuff, and still keep our hearts guarded in that peace. Don't forget the in Christ Jesus part of that. Because of Him and by His power. This is not something we do for ourselves. We don't acquire peace. We don't go to God in prayer and then we experience our own peace. And then we feel our own peace welling up within us. This is a gift from God, just as prayer itself. This is an aspect of God's grace. This is something that is done for those who have a covenant relationship with God. Rejoice in the Lord always. Again, I will say, rejoice. Does that describe your disposition? And does it mean that even on bad days and through difficult seasons of life, and when you have disappointment with others or maybe yourself, and when you feel lost and hopeless, because I think we all feel that way sometimes. It's not a real thing, but we feel it. Is it possible that we can look through the gloom and the darkness and all the sadness and the troubles and see what God has laying out there for us? And for that reason, enduring the cross, despising the shame of what we have to go through, we can find joy like Jesus did. Paul never said, rejoice only on good days when everything's right in your world, because that's just unrealistic, and chances are there's something wrong with everything. Paul never said, rejoice in the church, rejoice in the brotherhood, rejoice in your personal struggles, rejoice in your private torment. He says, rejoice in the Lord. Keep in front of you, keep your eyes and your faith fixed on the object of your joy. It's not a church building, and it's not a church service. It's not a sermon. It's not a religion. It's not a book. It's not a person like a human being that you know in this life. Rather, it's Jesus Christ. That's the person that we rejoice in and because of. The Lord is near. Soon this will all be over. That's true. But also the Lord is near to you, ready to listen, ready to help, ready to save. And when we trust in God and pray to God and cast our anxieties before his throne, as he's told us to do, that's the right attitude and the right action. And that's another secret of spiritual success. It's impossible to have spiritual success if you don't do those things. Christians who fail to rejoice also fail to pray in the manner that Paul described. And they fail to lay their fears and their burdens before the throne of grace. And they fail to be thankful to God and his gifts. And therefore, they will never experience that peace, not in this life and not in the life to come. This is both unacceptable and unnecessary, because as Christians, if indeed we are in Christ, we have privileged access to our Creator, to our Lord, to our King. He stands ready to help us. We have no good reason to feel hopeless and helpless when we have the most powerful being in the universe ready to help us, standing right next to us, saying, there's a storm ahead. I'll get you through it. You just have to trust me. God is saying through Paul, bring me your worries. Bring me your fears. Bring me your anxious thoughts. I'm asking for those. This is God speaking. I can handle those. You have questions. You have doubts. I'm offering solutions and I'm offering confidence. Draw near to me and I will draw near to you. What or who else can make such promises and keep them? You want somewhere to lay your burdens? I would suggest to you, lay them at the throne of God. Lay them at the cross of Christ. Whatever visual works for you. But you're doing the same thing in both cases. You're letting God take care of things. God provides the time, the place, the opportunity for those. Do you want peace that surpasses understanding? God has it, and he wants to give it to you. The question isn't, does he have it, and does he want to give it to you? The question is, do you want it for real? And what do you want, if not that? That's our lesson this morning, and I'm saying this lesson on the heels of what we've been hearing all week, or this last part of the week. I hope that all of it, Andy's lessons, this lesson, all come together as one big package of God cares about us. He wants to help us. He loves us. But we do have some responsibilities to him in the matter. And we need to be good for those. I hope that this has touched your heart. And I hope that you find solace in the idea here that God is for you and not against you. If there's anyone that needs to respond to our invitation, then we're going to be singing a song for that, and you can come forward if you need to as we stand and sing that song. Kyle selected.